Hello there. We're trying to keep Choral Chihuahua going, and so we draw your attention to the possibility of listening to us on Patreon for just a few quid a month. This also magically gets rid of the ads. That's Patreon with an E, patreon.com/choralchihuahua. On with the app.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Leather Lane near Holborn, and my favourite coffee bar in the world. This is Proof Rocks, and I've got the last of the cake. It's a sort of lemony thing, and a sort of Ethiopian espresso. Oh, sheer heaven. Hey, Sammy, how are you doing? Good. Here we are in London. Say the words.
Welcome to London.
And welcome to...
Choral Chihuahua.
Cool suspension.
So, yeah, welcome to this bit of London. I don't know this bit terribly well. We're near Hatton Gardens, all the jewellery quarters just over there.
That's right. It's lovely, isn't it? We rehearse quite near here, don't we, for in...
Exmouth Market.
That's right. Lovely. Good coffee.
Very good coffee. We do tend to try and find the place with the best coffee nearby.
No other reason really to rehearse, is there?
No. The first Italian church in London, around the corner from here, I've just been in. I had absolutely no idea. And restored buildings burnt down after the Great Fire of London, 1666. So not really antiques at all, because they're new. So that time I went into Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, and the guide was saying, of course, it's been ruined by the renovations, and we're all thinking 1970s, he means 1050 or something.
Exactly. So what are we going to hear first?
I've got a curiosité, unless you're Norwegian, because this was quite a big thing in Norway at the time. It's a disc called Bergtatt. It's the Oslo Chamber Choir, which Grete Pedersen set up in 1980-ish, and which she's conducting here. And it's, I ask you to think, this is an amateur choir. It doesn't sound like it. And this is extremely funky piece of folk music. Don't ask me to translate the Norwegian, because there isn't an English translation.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Absolute Chamber Choir, Greater Peterson, with certain supplementary instrumentalists. What do you think?
It's cool, isn't it? Lots to like. It's loads of... takes quite a lot, I think, to sound that spontaneous. It's a lot of rehearsal to get to that point, isn't it? Because it's precise. It sounds crude and kind of off the cuff, but it's absolutely together and well drilled, you'd say.
I don't know how many conductors could do that. She studied folk music as well as choral conducting. Now, of course, she's been conductor for years of the Norwegian Soloists Choir, as well as doing Carmel Bach Festival and all sorts, and comes over here occasionally. Have you ever met her?
Never met her.
No, nor I. Yeah, fantastic. Just incredible feel good. I think I remember having that. I've had that for 20 years, that CD. I think I was given it by a member of the Norwegian music board or something. We turned up for a gig and he was there. It was the gig when Roddy and I missed the plane and only turned up 40 minutes before the concert, which the promoter failed to see the funny side of.
Strange that, isn't it?
It was one of our stage programmes as well. Scary. Anyway, and they gave me these pile of CDs of stuff by Norwegian composers, and that one just sort of if you go to Spotify and look it up, it's that track there, which is the first track, is not the one with all the listens. The ones all the listens are, I think, well-known Norwegian folk tunes that people have gone to, but that I think is a that's great. And the particular track, it's called, oh dear, De Jondalen Ok Fry. Yeah, Bjarte Eike will be ringing in a correction.
Turning in his grave.
Til Jondalen og fri. And the full title is Nå vil jeg at til Jondalen og fri. Now I am going to the Jon Valley to propose. En typisk engelsk ignoranse og idioti. But nice try.
So not a piece either of us has ever performed, and nor are we likely to. I wonder if there's sheet music for it, but that's got a Jew's harp in it, before anyone asks. Has no relation to the Jews at all. Although it's thought that possibly Jews brought it over here and were selling them. But that's the thing that you put in the front of your mouth and you use your mouth to amplify the harmonics of the fundamental.
Did you used to extract your Jew's harp once in a while at Fazzini gigs?
No, that was my actual harp.
Ah, oh, I thought you had a Jew's harp as well.
No. Or if I have, I've sort of I've buried all memory of that. Right. I did have a harp crack in the middle of a rehearsal once, and Lindsay Wagstaff, who was singing with us at the time, hit the deck because it made it sound like a rifle shot, and her husband was military, and she'd learned
excellent
to go fast pace. No, I used to play something called the Planctus David by Pierre Abelard to my own accompaniment. I would sing it. It became known as David the Plankton. And I would get very emotional while singing it. And I seem to remember the Harrogate Observer crediting me. His voice, I forget whether it was racked or cracked with emotion, but I either was suitable. Anyway, what you got in your disgusting rucksack, to quote at your choral tour of a few months back?
So avid listeners will remember that I was about to go and do a Marian programme up in Scotland with Dunedin Consort, which happened, took place, nobody died. That was good. Really enjoyed it. Really, I mean, there's such a rich seam, isn't there, of that sort of repertoire. And I thought I'd bring a piece which was one of the newest pieces on the programme by old friend of the podcast, Cecilia McDowell, that she wrote for Nine Lessons and Carols at King's in 2021. Now, two things about this. Firstly, there's obviously a lot behind that particular service, a lot of kind of baggage, if you will. Disgusting rucksacks or otherwise. But the other thing was that I found it a little bit moving to think about Nine Lessons during COVID, because of course it would have still been, 21 would have been Omicron terror, and they'd have been trying to record stuff against all the odds, as we all remember all too well. And it's a magical, I say little piece, it's not little really. It's quite simple, deceptively simple. But very, very, if I can just find it, just a very simple, it's based on the setting of the There Is No Rose, the medieval lyric that we know from Ceremony of Carols or from the Joubert, I think is a famous setting of that. A macaronic text, which is lovely. Two languages set at once. And it's one of those pieces that sounds harder than it is. It was really simple to put together, very user-friendly, but very atmospheric, beautiful, mystical harmony. And something about the atmosphere, which I think is really special.
Now, I can imagine people sitting there thinking, oh, he means it sounds a bit like Eric Whittaker, which it utterly doesn't. It's completely, I mean, there's a lot of slow-moving Christmas around that sounds, it's written with that sort of framework in mind. But this is just totally her and totally different. And isn't it interesting how a composer later in life, she talked about this on our previous version of the podcast, came to composing quite late. And she's getting better and better as far as I can see.
It's good, isn't it? I think lots of things about experience that are kind of undervalued perhaps these days. Music history loves a prodigy, doesn't it? We love to think of Mozart thrilling the emperors and kings on his European tour. Mendelssohn, great prodigy. But just as many great composers who really found their feet later in life. Rameau, who wrote his first opera, I think, when he was 51, and then wrote kind of 30 in 20 years, all of which are full of staggering invention and beauty.
And frogs.
And taking me off my thread there somewhat.
Good. Well, while we're listening to this, people could be thinking about other composers that came to fruition quite late.
Well, two things. One is Jimmy Anderson, who's 40 and still weaving magic spells with the cricket ball. You'll appreciate that. And the other is the story about Pablo Casals, the great Catalan cellist, who a student asked him, why do you still practice so much? You're 95, you know, you've done everything there is to do. He says, I think I'm making progress.
I might finally be getting somewhere.
Exactly.
Thank you.
That's magic, isn't it?
I mean, I just think it's really, really brilliantly written. It's the simplest of ideas, and it just allows, she allows it to kind of germinate and flourish over the time. But it's very easy. It's very easy to put together as a performance. It's also, I think, really listener-friendly piece of music without condescending or patronizing. It's completely convincing bit of writing, beautiful textural interest.
And we were following the score while listening to it, and just lovely how she gets back to that that final return of the key again. The group, I think they're a sort of a group invented for OUP, is that?
It's likely, isn't it? The Oxford Choir with Ben Parry at the helm.
Who we'll be talking to in a few weeks' time. Actually, we'll be talking National Youth Choir things. Lovely. Oxford University Press Music. So I think that was done as a sort of show for one of their Christmas volumes.
Christmas albums, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic.
That's good, isn't it?
I did Radio 3's CD release last week, and we talked about... Well, I just use it as a link to why we're now going to start talking about... Clang yourself. Why we might talk about Monteverdi briefly, because there's a new recording of Orfeo out, and there are lots of recordings of Orfeo, of course. And I went back and I listened to the bit that we're just quickly going to look at, which is our favourite bit, the...
What's Act 5, isn't it? The Thracian Fields.
Thracian Fields. So this is post-party, post-hangover. Spoilers, he's been down to the underworld. What?
Isn't that right? I woke up this morning. Been down to the underworld.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Good. We can cut that a bit later.
So, Sammy, this is down to the underworld. He gets out again, having looked back very unwisely, and he's thrown out. Only for love of her does he look back. Seems kind of hard to punish him.
What an idiot, though.
Yeah, I know.
He had one job.
There's a good noise on this recording. Instead of there being a sort of terrifying sort of growing, it's just as if the stagehands have dropped a large box backstage. But actually, I listened to it with headphones on, and the whole thing is fantastic, amazing forward movement. Yeah. But it just got me thinking, because I think understanding of Monteverdi has moved on over 20 years. There are two recordings I used to love. One is with John Mark Ainsley, a hero, really, of mine, singing
absolutely.
It. Also, Ian Bostrich. It's a strange sound for the role. It doesn't quite fit there, but goodness, he's got, my opinion, or taste. It's all taste, of course. But he's got a certain amount of petulance, which I always think Orfeo should have. He's cross a lot of the time.
Yeah,
Orfeo,
he's a young guy, isn't he, with all that kind of restlessness and impetuosity. Yeah.
But this recording just has something a little bit more. It's a sound that naturally sort of fits in this world, and it's a singer from outside our immediate tradition of UK singers. It's a French singer. Sounds fantastic in Italian, but he's clearly had the same sort of background that you or me, lucky enough to sing in choirs. So he sung Masho, sung loads of madrigals, that kind of stuff. So he really hears his part against the continuo. And we're sitting here with the score. We're just going to show a couple of little things that we mean. It's not just that he hears his voice against the continuo. It's the fact that the continuo is not giving any quarter to the vocal part, which is something you and I know from the madrigals, that the bottom three parts provide really simple, normal root position chords most of the time, while the top parts are dissonant against it. And one of the problems with performance in the past with this kind of stuff is the continuo player sitting there trying to incorporate the melodic line, and it takes away all that colour. So let's just hear a couple of those phrases. So here's the basic harmony for this one. With this vocal part.
E mai sempre dorò mia Italia.
So there's no question of going dum, da, da, but just holding that chord and
I pianto.
And then the echo comes in.
Sconsolata sei.
Next bit is just D and A, and you sing.
E consolarmi voi ne dolor miei.
That sort of thing. It's good.
good, isn't it?
So these lovely, rich, rich moments that is just a dissonant line on top. But what you get in this recording now is a sort of insistence by the continuo, Andrew Lawrence King, who's playing harp, who really likes to drive it on and give no quarter to the singer at all rhythmically, which is quite a strong view. I think in this recording there's actually a little bit more give and take than he might have liked. But what it means is that because the harmony is always, you know, if I play, we all know that this is coming, or... And that produces its own rhythm, the speed at which the harmony flows. And that's, I think, why Monteverdi's different from other composers, because his music's got such a dry harmonic drive to it. Other composers write there and say, "The other day I went down to the shops, saw my girlfriend, and then I went home." And during that hanging around, there's no underfloor heating, I was going to say. There's no internal rhythm. So let's have a little bit of him really going for it. And he's really pissed off, I think. "You wept when our delight had vanished. Shall I grieve you forever?" He hears this echo picking up the end of his chord. "Sweet, lovable echo, you're disconsolate and you try to console me, though my eyes have become two fountains. But I couldn't shed enough tears, even if I had the eyes of Argus."
Lacrimaste voi sassi al dipartir del nostro sole, e io con voi lagrimerò mai sempre dorrò mia idoglia a pianto. Consolata sei, e consolarmi voi nei dolori miei, perché queste mie luci sien già per lagrimar fatte due fonti, in così grave mia fera sventura. Non ho pianto però tanto che basti. Se gli occhi d'avessi espandessero tutti un mar di pianto, non farà il duole conforme a tanti.
So that's from the new recording of L'Orfeo, recorded last year on the back of a production at the Opéra Comique, and then they were due to do it at the Palais de Versailles, but they couldn't because of COVID, so they thought, we're all booked, let's make a recording. And I'm sitting here thinking, you know, so what do you think of this recording I'm bringing to you? Turns out you've been on stage with them and done it. This is Jordi Savall and Le Concert des Nations and the tenor.
Yeah, well, Marc Moyon is who we heard there singing Orfeo. And we did a couple of concert performances ahead of the production, which I didn't then do. But yeah, I think he's brilliant. I think his voice is exactly the right voice for the role, isn't it?
That's so rare to find someone who's got the gravel at the top, at the bottom, and then the freedom at the top.
Yeah, it's not easy, is it? I don't know. When I sang with Mark, he was calling himself a baritone, or maybe even baritone Martin, which is the sort of Pelléas type. A high baritone
called Martin,
exactly, a typical French baritone in lots of ways, but I think it's absolutely his role. I think he's very committed, like I say, he's full of energy and anger and all the right sort of, you know, you and I always talk to our students about getting them to invest in and embody the emotions, and he really does that, doesn't he?
And this drive, what's it like being then with that particular continuo group who've played it together for years, you look back at that famous one of them in the Liceu, where Jordi Savall walks down with the full Monteverdi, yeah. The full Monteverdi cape on, Batman. Because that sense of drive that I spoke briefly to Andrew Lance King about, the harpist, who's sort of really being one of the main characters in the revival of early harps.
He's on the recording, isn't he?
Yeah, very much. And he's got very strong ideas about how the pulse shouldn't be bent.
Well, you and I mentioned just sort of off air, if you like, that Monteverdi's music is as much about time as anything. And this sense that, particularly in these larger scale works, this sense that he's baked into the music a sense of expectation and surprise and fulfilment and all those kind of things. And that if you lose that sense of time beating cosmically, as it were, which is one of Andrew's terms.
Cosmic.
Then you lose a lot of the power of the music, I think. Of course, it's a piece about the power of music as well. Andrew is, he's pretty strong in his opinions. But
hardline?
Yeah, you could say that. But it's difficult, isn't it?
I think interesting talking about him. He was saying, you know, the continue playing must drive on, and the singer like Ella Fitzgerald pulls it around. I mean, I don't think you can quite do that, and he hasn't quite done that here. I mean, he's a member of a team here, but there's actually just enough lassitude for the singer to hang themselves with. There's just enough pull, but that thing about the dissonance being written just one side of the beat. And if you pull that, then you end up effectively with something on the beat. It's like singing, and we get a lot of musical theatre singing up at University of York in exams, and there's a lot of, you know, with the pulse going, ba-da-da-da-da, and if you sing late, it comes ba-da-da-da-da, and you end up losing the effect that the composer's written in. Stephen Sondheim, very keen that his music should be performed as notated.
I think there's a few things on that. Andrew's hardline, but firstly, he's generally right, I think, about the sense of it being at least where you start from. You start with the music as written. I mean, why you wouldn't, I don't understand.
Because people think it's recitative.
Exactly.
I think is the worry, which is kind of extrapolating back from later music. This is related to madrigals. You just, unlike most other composers who wrote madrigals and then tried to write in this style, he hasn't gone to simply writing chords and with some recitative over the top of it. He's kept the same harmonic processes, just ripped the middle three voices out.
Yeah, and lots of people, I think, make the mistake that because it's a bass line and a melody, if you like, it looks like Mozartian or Handelian recit. It's just not. It's a very different musical structure, isn't it? The other thing about Jordi, obviously, his team have lived with that piece for, I guess, upwards of 30, 40 years. It's nothing, you know, they've forgotten more than most of us know about it. And as a team, they're just brilliant. Because Andrew is quite, you know, relatively hardline, quite opinionated. He's pretty strict on singers in rehearsal. Andrew, Jordi keeps his hands pretty clean on the whole. But then you've got other members of the team who just kind of soften that. And it's a fantastic kind of organism, if you like, no pun intended, that works the continuo in that piece for him, which I think is one of the things that makes that particularly successful.
You can hear traces in here of the operatic platform. They're used to doing things. And of course, there's very little time for the music in these kind of productions. And as soon as the stage director gets hold of it, you find yourself pulling things about. And to have had that hard line to start with, it's going to be pretty helpful, I think.
Absolutely.
Oh, good old Claudio. Marvellous. You and I sing some Monteverdi in a couple of weeks, aren't we, in our Angels and Demons programme. And then we're singing Cristoforo Caresana.
Is that the Tarantella?
Yes, that's the Tarantella, which is Naples sort of pantomime, Monteverdi-style pantomime. This is down at Star Music. And then we're doing Juan Frances de Iribarren.
Lovely. That's a fun piece, isn't it? It's a Christmas piece, I think.
The entire programme is a Christmas. I just fancy doing Christmas programming in
boss,
June. So. Well, you've just you started it. You invaded Poland. No, you started it. You brought in a Christmas piece of for this concert.
But we lasted it. Avid listeners will also remember we did that in Norway.
Yes, in January.
In January.
With a lot of snow.
Snø, exactly.
Yeah. How many Norwegian words are there for snow?
Loads.
One. Oh. That was Tom Guthrie saying that to Beate Eike on stage. And I believe you have more than 20 words for snow. And Beate says, no, just the one, snø. And if you like your snø, here's a fact that I've made up, but I think it's true. Having moved to York 11 years ago and hearing the snø accent up there, I reckon that's Viking.
I think
that's Viking, east of the country. People don't say oh, they say snø.
This loops me back to a slightly to the first piece we heard, which is the Norwegian chamber choir. And I used to do, Matt Long does it now, but I used to go and sing with a guy called Peder Rensvik up in Kristiansund, which is the north of Norway. And his wife was called Margaret, a lovely lady, is called Margaret, should I say. Peder died recently, very sadly. She's from Middlesbrough. And to hear her speak English and Norwegian, it was never quite clear which one it was, because they were so closely related in that particular personage.
You get that in Newcastle sometimes. the Newcastle Denmark collection. Yeah. Or once on a plane from Liverpool to Holland, I couldn't tell the person of the other side of aisle whether that was Liverpool or Dutch. Turned out to be Liverpool. We've had three Northern Irish altos in the 24 this term, which is fantastic. And we've been, you know, the word cloud came up. Cloud.
I wandered lonely as a cloud.
That's been fun doing diphthongs. I mean, they just go straight into English vowel sounds. They've obviously been trained to.
When they sing.
Yeah, okay. And that must be the same actually, you hear a lot with American choirs. And actually, hearing an American choir, there's a recording of Eric Whitaker's with the American University Choir, and it's really rather lovely hearing them doing their own vowels and not trying to sing English ones.
Yeah.
Where are we going next, then?
What is next?
Victoria.
Ah, yes.
Yes. I will go and run about.
So this is a setting of part of the Song of Songs.
Curious book.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? I mean, we love it because it's produced such fabulous music, but it's a slightly unsettling.
It's in the Bible by mistake.
Surely.
I remember a monk telling me once that it's just erotic Hebrew wedding poetry and what it was doing in the Old Testament. But mind you, Thomas Aquinas would say you can read scripture in four ways, only one of which is literal, which is probably just as well, because this is erotic Hebrew poetry. This isn't too erotic until we start talking about fresh fruit.
So the text is, shall we read the whole thing?
Yeah, do.
Yes. I will rise and I will go about the city. In the streets and the broadways, I will seek him whom my soul loveth. I sought him and I found him not. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him that I languish with love.
Qui amore langue, or Howard Ferguson, entire oratorio called Qui amore langue. Ah.
And then the second part is, what manner of one is thy beloved that thou hast so adjured us? My beloved is white and ruddy.
Candidus et rubicundus.
Something about crossing the Rubicon. Anyway, electus ex millibus, chosen out of thousands. Such is my beloved, and he is my friend, O ye daughters of Jerusalem. Whither is thy beloved gone, O thou most beautiful among women? Whither is he turned aside? And we will seek him with thee.
And then for no apparent reason,
I will go up into the palm tree and will take hold of the fruit thereof.
Ow.
Yeah. So this is, firstly, it's worth saying that it's sort of excerpts grabbed from little bits. It's not a continuous passage. Mm. It's obviously a dialogue. In the text, which he's set in a sort of three upper voices, three lower voices way. We're coming back slightly to Monteverdi madrigals in that sense. And I just think it's an absolutely wonderful piece. When we were preparing preparing the episode, we couldn't really find an ideal recording, it's fair to say, isn't it?
No, we're looking at them. I mean, there's a Stile Antica one, which I think is 11 and a half minutes long. Oxford Camerata, which is Jeremy Summerlee's group from the 90s with an unbelievable lineup of singers, they were They were, I think, the same. So I went to the 16s, which is, I think, only 8.5 minutes. John Elliott Gardner managed to spin it out to 13.5.
I sang that with him in Avila Cathedral, where there's a bit of graffiti on the stalls, which is Victoria's name, whether it's Ria, I don't know, but that was special. Because, oh, yes, it was slow.
Because he and Vivanka were both choristers there.
Exactly. They're all quite... There are slow ones, and in fact, Jeremy Summerlee's recording with the Oxford Camerata is also slow, but I think it's worn apart. It's got some sensational singing. I think it's probably not the tempo one would choose personally, but
they make it work, and that's the thing. You can make it work in the building. I don't know where they've recorded it, but there are also legends singing on there. James Gilchrist singing tenor.
James Gilchrist and Andrew Carwood on tenor.
Andrew Carwood, now the choirmaster at St Paul's Cathedral.
The great Caris Lane.
Caris Lane. For me, absolutely distinctive sound as soon as it starts.
Completely unmistakable, isn't it? Amazing on all those early recordings with Jeremy, and yeah, just it's a big piece. So it takes its time to kind of unfold like a flower, and some of the word setting is almost baroque in its kind of sensuality and
yeah, it's not straight polyphony, is it? It's polyphony, but not as we know it, Jim.
Yeah, exactly. And I think if one were to come to it now, I think further down the track I'm going to do it next year, one would want a balance of this kind of listening polyphony, polyphonic singing, and individual kind of emotionality in the singing, which is what we're so often after, isn't it?
Or emotion.
Yeah, emotionality is more syllables, though. So it must be better.
Must be better. We're gonna finish with that. We're
terrible way to finish. Too many syllables.
Patting ourselves on the back because we've actually got an episode out. We didn't mean to break for quite this long, but we've got a few episodes at least lined up now. We hope we haven't recorded them yet, but we thought we ought to do one. Otherwise, we wouldn't start again. Eamon will be back with us shortly, and you're going to be talking to youth. You're going to be talking about youths and young voices.
Yeah, I'm hoping to put together something about young. Unchanged voices and also changing voices, and just talk to some professionals who deal with that. Such a sensitive thing, and obviously it's always going to be the news. It's particularly the news at the moment because Scott Price, who I'm hoping will come and talk to us, he has a boy at Cardinal Vaughan who's in the final of Britain's Got Talent at the moment. So he's putting treble singing on the TV.
Malachi,
yeah. He's a brilliant kid. I mean, he's lovely, but he sings just so beautifully. He's, at the moment, particularly, I think I was telling you, I did a Monteverdi Vespers with them last month. Yeah, gosh, feels that longer ago. And he sang Pulchres as beautifully as one really has heard it. It's really sensational. You know, the best treble singing is an amazing thing, isn't it? And I'm hoping just to pick Scott's brains and a couple of others about that.
And Pulchres will take us back to... Vado, vadam et circuibo civitatem, I will rise and go about the city, which I think in the when it's not just select bits of the Song of Songs but flows on, leads into a rather strange thing about being beaten on the head by the watchman.
It rings a bell, but...
A bit unnecessary, and clearly Victoria thought so as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Bye.
Just before you go, another reminder to try listening on Patreon, which costs just a few pounds per month. Or if you prefer, you can very simply make a one-off donation. You can actually do either via choralchihuahua.com. Thanks.